The following lecture, Afghanistan in the Neighborhood, is by Professor Jeremy Suri, Department of History, University of Wisconsin-Madison. In this talk, Professor Suri describes the culture and history of Afghanistan, the influences of surrounding countries and competing empires, and how we might be able to provide Afghans at least the opportunity of stabilizing their country. This event was sponsored by the Madison Institute and was held in Madison on March 28, 2009. Professor Jeremy Suri.
I'm going to talk about what I'm calling the Afghanistan-Pakistan War, because I really do think it's a war. We better start calling it that. And we better start linking Afghanistan and Pakistan together. And I thought one of the very best things that the president did was he talked about these as interrelated. We cannot talk about one without the other. Now, you guys did that when you invited me, but it's nice to know that people are finally recognizing that. I'm going to try to do six things today, which is more than I usually try to do in a lecture. My rule for lecturing is three main points. But there's so much to say, and this is such a smart group that I thought I'd do six things. Failed states. What are failed states? How many people have seen that phrase before, by the way? Good. All right, so it's a common term. What is that? What are failed states? I want to talk a little bit about the history of the region. I have to do that. I'm a historian. And I think it's crucially important, and the history is crucially misunderstood by many people. Then I want to talk about the Taliban. Who are these people? Then I want to talk about counterinsurgency in that region, but also historically. Then nation building, and then the prospects for the future. So that's a lot cover, but these are all interrelated issues. That's the region we're focused on there, the green and the orange. I put that up because it's really important to see where this region is in relation to the rest of the world, not just in its immediate area. It is small and distant from us, but it is very close to what we might call some of the key regions for resource extraction, i.e. the oil of the Middle East. So it's close to areas of important resource extraction. Also, very, very close to the Indian subcontinent. Everyone notice that? I have to point that out. My father's from India. That's why I have the last name Suri. And we're actually Hindu Punjabi. So technically, you could trace the roots of my family probably to this precise region that we're talking about today. Though, actually, my father and my grandfather came of age in India proper. My grandfather in British India. My grandfather was actually in the Royal Air Force in Indian control or British controlled India. But I bring this up because there's something important in that. This is an area of traditional movement of peoples. These are not areas or regions of the world that have a long history of, shall we say, settled populations. These are regions of movement. We say nomadism. That's not quite right either, because nomadism implies that people are constantly moving and don't establish long-term locations. These are areas of short-term settlement and continued movement. And that's very important as well. Resources and the movement of peoples. Third point about that region that should be obvious also, right? It is an important crossroad for trade. This is, though distant from the area of capitalist wealth, it is a key area of global capitalism. Traders going back and forth, particularly between India and Russia, right? How many people have heard of the Great Game? The Great Game was the long-standing rivalry between Great Britain and Russia for control over just the region we're talking about today. Why were they rivals over control for this region? Well, it was near resources, but also it was a key trading area for access to where? India. Right? If you want to understand British strategy anywhere, it's all about India. If you want to understand Russian strategy with regard to Great Britain, it's all about India. And this trade position is very important, right? One historian writes that Afghanistan is the Poland of Central Asia, right? It is the Poland of Central Asia. The big powers come through, right? One way, and depending on when you're looking at it, it's under the control or influence of one side or the other, though never fully as such, right? It has one advantage, of course, Poland doesn't have, which is a mountainous terrain. If only the Poles had mountains, it would have made it more difficult for the Russian and German armies to run through, right? But like Poland, right, it is so close to the big powers and so far from God, right? Okay, let me say a little bit about this term failed states. Let's go to the first point on my list here, failed states. What are failed states? And what do we mean by that term? Let's look at Afghanistan as we see it today, right? One of the most difficult things that we have as Americans looking at these issues is we see a map like this and it looks like one entity, right? And we even color it in, right? There's Afghanistan in one color, the region around it in another color. Here is the area that we would call Afghanistan. The borders are borders that generally have been recognized internationally, but not recognized internally. Recognized internationally, but not recognized internally. That's point number one in understanding what a failed state is, right? Where the international demarcation of political authority does not match the domestic demarcation of political authority, and where there is a great gap between those two, right? Think about that in contrast. Think about that in contrast to what we are accustomed to when we think about states in Europe or in the United or in North America, right? There might be some dispute over whether a border should be exactly one place or another, but everyone pretty much knows where the United States ends and Mexico begins. You pretty much know where France ends and Belgium begins when you are traveling, right? And most people do not hotly contest these issues. That is not the case. That is not the case with Afghanistan. These border demarcations do not reflect the lived experiences of people within, and they certainly do not reflect the political allegiances. So one definition of a failed state is the difference between recognitions of political authority. The second element of a failed state is what I would call the infrastructure of power. The infrastructure of power, right? How does one in a local area feel the writ of some kind of central authority? Kabul is the capital. But do people on a daily basis feel that? Do they know that? Afghanistan is an area, actually, where there's been a great deal of money invested over the last 100 years in road construction of one kind or another. But it is still an area that is widely dispersed without centralized infrastructures of authority, right? For example, one of the most obvious things, there is not a working central tax administration. Now, you might this time of year say, well, that's great, right? But that is actually one of the central demarcations of whether you have a functioning state or not. Is there an entity at the center that can collect tax money and then redistribute or use that money as such for purposes defined by the state? Such a process does not exist in Afghanistan, and in fact never has, right? That would be the key infrastructure of authority. The third element, the most important element in thinking about, I would say, state authority is who has the guns. Right? Or in Max Weber's terms, right? Who has the monopoly or the near monopoly over violence? That's why we say, by the way, right, there might be parts of inner cities in the United States that are not under state control, right? There are parts of Chicago and parts of Los Angeles where actually it's not clear that state authorities actually have the monopoly on violence, right? That is the norm. That is the norm in Afghanistan. That does not mean that it is an area always of violence. In fact, there's a history of nonviolence in Afghanistan as well that I'll talk about. But it means that authority, military authority, is dispersed. So those warlords, as we know them, we call them warlords because they look to us like unnatural actors with access to military force, right? The way to think about them, actually, is that they are local political administrators in a system where there is no centralized monopoly over violence. So unlike Governor Jim Doyle, right, who rules within the framework of United States political force and military power, they have the control over military power in a way the federal government does in the United States. That's very important. That is, by the way, not historically unusual. Right? That would be the case for most societies 2 centuries ago. Right? That would be the case for most of them 2 centuries ago. And there's no reason to believe that our notion of state-centered military force is necessarily the way the world is going, right? We shouldn't necessarily assume that, right? It is a very Western point of view to say that all states should have military authority controlled in these particular ways. Why is it different in Afghanistan? Part of it's the terrain. Part of it's the terrain, but there's a much deeper issue, it seems to me, that I want to spend a couple minutes to linger on. And that has to do with the actual external pressures upon this region, right? One of the most important things, coming back to my first point, that makes this a failed state is that there is not the established set of restraints upon foreign influence over who has control of which resources. One of the first things a state has to do, right, is close off or control external influence upon the internal development of its institutions, right? And the entire history of Afghanistan is the history of the opposite of that, the opposite of that. It comes back to this, being at the crossroads between such big powers, right? Powers that have continuously had an interest in inserting themselves in this region. There has, in essence, been what scholars would call the intentional underdevelopment of statehood in the region, the underdevelopment of statehood in Afghanistan as such, right? External powers influencing, interfering in the society to prevent it from developing its own state institutions. There is no reason to believe, no reason to believe that Afghanis are any less likely or less willing to form states than Indians, right? India has a functioning state because the British isolate the area pretty much from external areas and build state institutions. Afghanistan does not have a state because external entities did the opposite thing, interfered to prevent a single state from developing as such, right? So even when you have what people would recognize as a somewhat functioning Afghanistani state from 1945 to 1978 or so, it is really not an independent state. It is a state reflecting the influence of many areas, many groups around it. It does not function as we define its functionality. This is very important. This is about more than geography. It's about more than mountains. There are mountain societies that have states. They might look different, right? But if you've been to Italy, you might be frustrated by the way the Italian state works. But it actually is a state, right? It's not just the terrain. It's the location and the role of the external powers. Look at the borders of Afghanistan, right? You've got Iran. You've got Iran. You've got the stands, as we call them, right? Areas of great Russian influence, right? You've got China, and you've got India. And that would be the British Empire, 47 before, and then India thereafter, right? This is a tough neighborhood. This is a difficult neighborhood for state building, a very difficult neighborhood for state building. Each of the states around Afghanistan, each of the states around Afghanistan has advantages in state building that Afghanistan does not have. Iran has oil, right? So the Shah can buy a state, in a sense, right? And that's, in essence, what he does, right? India and Pakistan have the British Empire, and they have sea access, right? So they can actually be involved in international trade without the kind of landed control that others have, right? Russia has the enormous resource manpower base that Russia has, and China has the same thing, right? Afghanistan does not have any of that. Again, it's the Poland of Central Asia. The Poland of Central Asia. And if you know your Polish history, the Polish state has not had a long history, a long and easy history itself. This brings us to the second point about history that I wanted to discuss. Afghanistan is not an area that is necessarily prone, I would argue, to horrific extremism. It's not an area that's necessarily prone to more violence than other areas. That's not what I've been saying, and that's a misreading of the history. And it is not the graveyard of empires. That's the phrase that's often used. In fact, it's even used in today's New York Times, the graveyard of empires. It's not the graveyard of empires. The history of Afghanistan is of it being part of long-term imperial rivalries. It has been an area where it has been difficult for military entities to establish long-term control. But it is not an area that is particularly, shall we say, anarchic, or particularly chaotic, or particularly ungovernable. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the ways in which the external forces around this contribute to difficulties, but not the inherent element of Afghanistan itself. We have to get away from thinking that just because they have mountains, just because they have difficult terrain, and just because they've had hundreds of years of foreign powers fighting there and not succeeding in their aims, that Afghanistan is therefore going to be backward forever. Be careful, right? There is a kind of condescending imperialism in the way people say, oh, it's Afghanistan, stay out of it, right? As if they're just backward people, so we should just leave them in the Middle Ages, right? That's not at all the case. In fact, the story of Afghanistan is of it being a very creative, dynamic trading society, a society that's been between empires, but not the graveyard of empires. Let's just go through that a little bit, if we might. In the 16th century, Afghanistan is actually the core for what becomes the most significant Indian dynasty, pre-British occupation of India, the Mughal dynasty, right? We've both heard of the Mughal dynasty, M-U-G-H-A-L, right, under Babur the Great. If you have been to the Taj Mahal, that was built by the Mughal dynasty, right? Mughal dynasty was centered in Afghanistan and then moved out from there, actually, into India. And what it provided and made India wealthy and rich before the British arrived was it provided access for India to some of the greatest learning and intellectual activity outside the Indian subcontinent. Afghanistan actually became a crossroad for trade with China and other parts of the world, and also became a crossroad for intellectual influences. It was not that India became backward because it was connected to Afghanistan. It was that India actually developed because of the access to trade and intersections through Afghanistan. Under the period of the British Empire, Afghanistan was an area neither fully controlled by the British nor fully controlled by the Russians. But it was an area also of significant and continual trade between those empires. The story of Afghanistan was of trade between Britain and India and the difficulties between British and Indian control and Russian control, but not this being an area where the British were trying to fight and get defeated time and again. The British fought two wars in Afghanistan in the 1840s and the 1880s, and then there's another one they fight in the early 20th century. These wars in Afghanistan were not wars over the occupation of Afghanistan. They were wars over efforts by the British to control what they saw as elements within Afghanistan that were imperiling British interests. These were punitive wars, and they were not successful. But they were not unsuccessful because Afghanistan is ungovernable. They were unsuccessful because the British did not have the wherewithal, nor did they know who the appropriate people were to target, nor did they know how to do it. But that was the problem of British military power and the misuse of British force. It was not something ungovernable about Afghanistan. Okay, it was not something ungovernable about Afghanistan. The 1870s, the British actually had a pretty good working relationship with the Afghans, right? The problem was other areas exerting or attempting to exert influence within this area known as Afghanistan. This was not an ungoverned area. In fact, the period that we might call British colonialism was a period of multiple British negotiations. Yes, ma'am. This lady's asking a wonderful question. Who are the external forces? And the external forces are partially what we would call paramilitary units being sent in through Iran, Russia, Pakistan, India, and others, traders, religious actors, missionaries. All of these groups are coming through here. And they're not, by the way, just Islamic missionaries. They're Christian missionaries there throughout the 19th century. Kabul is filled with Christian missionaries. There aren't really Hindu missionaries, but there are sort of Hindu influences coming in there as well. So it's an area with many groups coming into it, right? What I'm trying to get us to stop thinking is that it's one entity, and then once in a while someone shows up, makes a mistake, and has to leave, right? That's not what it is, right? One of the debates we have is, should we just leave Afghanistan alone? There's no leaving Afghanistan alone, right? It's a society that has been infiltrated and penetrated by all kinds of groups around it historically and through the present, right? And where I'm going with that is that's the story of the drug trade as well, right? I'll just sort of flash ahead, right? I think 88 to 90% of the world's opium comes from this area, but it's doesn't just come from that area because the Afghanis produce it and send it out. It comes from that area because there are all kinds of influences that are in there contributing to and encouraging Afghanistan to grow that stuff, right? The drug trade is an international set of influences, right? It's not one entity acting. It's not just supply and demand, right? So this internationalization of Afghanistan is, I think, a really important thing. It's different from what we could think of as American state building, right? American state building does not occur with all kinds of foreign influences. There are trading influences and others, but Americans benefit, right, as Washington says, from to some extent being able to separate themselves and build their own society and then go back out into the world. They dealt with it as an administrative region and then dealt with individual entities within it. But they did not treat it as one country as such. And that's actually really important because even India was not treated as a single country by the British. They had an India office, which was separate from the Foreign Office. and the India office oversaw a variety of arrangements with India, but they did not see India as a country. The beginnings of the notion of India as a single state does come from the British, but it comes during World War I, right? During World War I, the British have a manpower shortage, right? The British are not a land power, they're a sea power, right? If you look at that map, it's obvious why, right? One question I always ask my undergraduates, and maybe we should actually spend a second on it now. I wasn't intending this, but let's spend a second on it now. There's Great Britain. Look how tiny it is. And in fact, my Scottish friends would say, that's more than just Great Britain. That's Britain and Scotland. Well, right. But let's just include that all, right, for a second, right? Look how small it is. And I don't have this map with me. I should have brought it. There, you could, and we've all seen it, though, right? Half the world painted red by the British, right? Including India, right? Including East Africa, right? Including Canada, right? How does such a small island control such a large part of the world? Working indirectly, right? Finding local entities to work on their behalf. And that is definitely how the Romans did it. Though even the Romans are a land power in the way the British aren't, right? But that use of indirect rule is crucial. It's part of the answer, right? The British don't actually ever intend, until World War I, to rule India as we would think of ruling India today, right? They want to make deals with the various Maharajas and others for access. Their people were willing to go, and in places like India and Afghanistan and today's Pakistan, right, the British did not seek, though, to have their men and women, right, controlling everyday life. They wanted their men and women negotiating with local entities who would then exert control on behalf of the British. And British policy in Afghanistan is exactly that. The wars the British fight in Afghanistan are never wars over taking control of Afghanistan as we would think of it today, right? They are wars over trying to get rid of local actors that they see as imperiling British interests and getting their local actors in there, right? And that's exactly what the Romans would do, right? By the way, the way the British run their empire is in part that, through that. The other is, this group knows this, you just didn't say it. I mean, this is what you guys focus on, right? It's transportation, right? Another way of saying that, transportation, right, is capitalism, right? They control this, they do this because they control the world capitalist economy. How do they control the world capitalist economy? Well, they don't just control the shipping. Right? That's important, be able to get stuff from one place to another. They control the insurance, right? Lloyd's of London, right? They control the actual regulation of movement of entities across the water, and therefore in controlling how resources move, and eventually controlling communications, they're able to control the allocation of wealth, right? And what they do through indirect rule, right? They go in to a local leader in Afghanistan, for instance, the grandfather of Massoud, the great Northern Alliance leader who was killed 2 days, or 1 day was it before the September 11th attack? One day before, right? His grandfather had been on the British payroll, right? The British go in and they say, here's a bunch of money, and we'll offer you protection and access to these goodies. You do this for us. That's the genius of their administration, right? You do this for us. And by the way, don't deal with the Russians. Don't deal with this group, right? That's how indirect rule works. That's how they do it. World War I, by the way, messes that up, and it's crucial for Afghanistan. It messes that up for them because during World War I, for the first time ever, the British do not have enough people to run this system anymore because the killing in Europe, right, is going on too long and killing too many people, right? This is the problem of trench warfare for Great Britain, right? We've all read the war poets, Siegfried Sassoon and others, Wilfred Owen, are talking about this. 5 years of trench warfare with heavy casualties without movement of lines drains Britain of the resources it has to play a role in Europe and to manage this empire, right? So what does Britain have to do? It has to go to areas like India in particular, and it has to say, give us your people to fight in our army. Give us your people to fight in our army, which requires Britain no longer to have indirect rule, but to have direct rule, right? If you have indirect rule, as Britain has in Afghanistan until that moment, you are not ruling over the people of Afghanistan. you are ruling over their rulers, right? So the people of Afghanistan, the people of India, still see themselves responding to a Maharaja or a local leader. That's why I said there was no state in Afghanistan, right? The Afghanistanis saw themselves as the subjects of one particular ruler in one particular part of this area. And that part might cross a present-day border. The British have to change that in World War I. This is the key historical moment, because now they have to go in and say, it's not enough for us to rule your rulers. We need your bodies as citizens. And we need to take your bodies into the war. So how many people have been to New Delhi? Right? You saw the India Gate. Right? What's the India Gate? Right, and what's on it? Why is it there? The India Gate is in the center of Lytton's part of New Delhi, the modern British part that was built by Edward Lytton's, right? The gate in the center is an Arc de Triomphe for New Delhi, right? On the Indian Arc de Triomphe, right, are the names of tens of thousands of Indians who died fighting in the British Army in World War I. That's at the center of the modern part of New Delhi, right? There is no such gate prior to World War I. There is no such experience prior to that. That changes things. That's a key moment in Afghanistan as well. Because what happens with World War I, see, everything is about World War I, right, Bill? Not the Civil War. World War I, right? With World War I now, this arrangement starts to break down. There is more of a demand for the extraction, not just of resources, but of bodies of this area. And you get the creation of then efforts at state building in areas that have not had states and do not have the infrastructure for states as such. Right? The very points I made before about Afghanistan lacking those issues, being a penetrated area. It's being penetrated from multiple areas, but at the same time now, the British are seeking to pull themselves in and pull out people from the region, quite literally, right? And in fact, another version of this story, right, is North Africa, right? Who is it who builds the railroads in North Africa at this time? It's people from this area. It's Indians and Afghans, and they don't call themselves that at the time, right? It's British labor. They take labor into the army, and they take labor, and they move it to Africa to build railroads so they can now control that area as well, right? Kenya is dominated by, the business community in Kenya is dominated by people from this very region, right? By Gujaratis and others, Gujaratis and Punjabis, right, who are moved to Kenya. They become, after they build the railroads, they become one of the dominant business classes in Kenya. One of the big worries of last year was what was going to happen with all the turmoil in Kenya to the Indian communities that are still not seen by many Kenyans as Kenyan. Whatever that means, that's another discussion. So these are important historical points. There's another historical point I want to raise that we often lose sight of. During this entire period of the rivalries of empires and the batting back and forth of Afghanistan, this is an area that is constantly being penetrated and constantly also fighting wars. Constantly involved. It is a war-torn area. And we should not have this image that there is a war fought and people lose and leave, another war fought and people lose and leave. In fact, there's never not war being fought in this area, right? It is an area of contestation, an area of unsettled activity. War, as one person writing on this says, you know, war is normal life in this region, for better or for worse, right? That's really important. For us, just thinking about it, just as a point as an aside, right? If that's the case, right, we shouldn't expect that some sort of set of actions by us is going to end that overnight, right? We should not expect that. The king of Afghanistan, Zahir Shah, everyone remember Zahir Shah? Right? He had a nice life in southern Italy until he was asked to come back for a short while, right? Zahir Shah is actually, like so many of the monarchs in this region, someone picked out by these external entities to be seen as the unifying figure. And what Zahir Shah does from the period after the Second World War through to 1972 or so is he seeks to make Afghanistan a player in the alliances between the United States and the Soviet Union. He seeks to make Afghanistan kind of like what India is trying to do, as a sort of non-aligned entity working with both sides in the Cold War. And what the Cold War provides in Afghanistan, and this is one of the most important historical points, right? It provides that rare moment when there is actually a limitation on external influence in Afghanistan from 47 to 72, just for that period. And I say 72 for a reason I'll explain in a minute, right? During that period, the United States and the Soviet Union both seek to limit the activities of the other in this area because they were afraid that this region is going to get out of control. So the external powers are actually controlling, regulating limited authority. It's the opposite of what had happened before. And it creates this short period when Afghanistan is relatively free of the kinds of external influences we've been talking about. So the Cold War is a unique moment in Afghanistan. That changes in the early 1970s, especially in 72 and 73, when an internal communist party in Afghanistan, operating largely on its own, it has some Soviet support, but it's really operating on its own. We forget that there were communist parties that actually had some indigenous support, not the communist parties in Europe, right, but the communist parties elsewhere, Latin America, Afghanistan. They stage a coup, which is what forces Zahir Shah to leave and go to southern Italy. And they establish a communist regime in Afghanistan. And it's that regime that in 1978-79 gets into trouble that calls in Soviet influence. When the Soviet Union invades in 1979, it breaks this short period of limited external influence there. But the Soviet Union does it not because the Soviet Union is intent on moving in and taking control of Afghanistan. The Soviet Union has a different problem. That a communist government with some degree of local support in parts of Afghanistan is in trouble because it hasn't been able to consolidate authority, and as a consequence is asking for Soviet help. And it is difficult for the Soviet Union not to intervene in those terms. They were mostly Pashtun, but not entirely. Right? And the ethnic tensions are an important part of it. One of the reasons they're in trouble is because they have difficulty getting support from the Tajik and Uzbek influenced groups. The second problem that the communist government has is it's very difficult to actually run the economy. They have difficult economic problems, especially in the 1970s. And you might remember the late 1970s were not an easy time in the international economy in general, right? Yeah, and they are stupid borders. They are basically drawn up by the European powers who are trying to demark authority in the area because, again, they want to figure out who can get which bodies into which army. So yeah, this is what become the borders of Palestine and Syria and Jordan. I mean, Jordan itself is created out of this. Palestine exists, but doesn't really have that kind of entity. So these borders are World War I borders, and they're constantly being negotiated and renegotiated, and then that stops. People just sort of leave them where they are. It's definitely true for the border around. It's true for this part of the border, for the western border, and for the northern border. This southern and eastern border is actually not drawn as clearly because the British have control over India. So they actually, that border is a little less clearly. That border comes more from 47 with the creation of an independent India. Then they sort of make that border firmer. They part of the Churchill and other groups that are working on that. But it's the borders with Iran and what is then the Soviet Union. I mean, you can see here with this map of Pakistan, you can see that it's quite natural around the Khyber Pass and areas like that, especially in the northwest of Pakistan, which we're going to talk a lot about in a few minutes, right? The borders are natural and unnatural at the same time. They're natural in the sense that the mountainous area along here clearly makes it difficult to move from this side to this side. And it's a problem the American military is having right now. Amazing, the Khyber Pass remains such a critical area, right? So that's a natural border in a sense. But the problem is what happens to those regions that actually have the mountains in them? Which side are they on? That's unnatural. So it's as if there were, I guess a way of thinking about it, is as if there were a different country west of the Rocky Mountains. And the United States was east of the Rocky Mountains. What would you do with the Rocky Mountains? Exactly, a very wide borderland. The approach to solving that problem of a wide borderland has generally been to create a demilitarized zone. But no one has had the authority to actually create a demilitarized zone there. But that's actually what one would want, right? If Obama is to get his way, that's really what he's looking for, is to make that mountain area. We don't care if it's Pakistan or Afghanistan, right? But we care that it's demilitarized. And in fact, right now, it's just the opposite. But you all remember this. That's what the Tora Bora stuff was all about, right? That's what was going on at that point. I want to get us to Pakistan in a second. I want to make one other historical point related to ethnic groups within Afghanistan. I've held off on talking about ethnic groups because I think it's very historically dangerous to start marking people out by their ethnic groups. Okay? It doesn't mean that ethnicity doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that where one comes from doesn't matter. It matters enormously. But it's dangerous because ethnic groups do not create self-contained communities. And the story of Afghanistan is a story of ethnic tensions, but also ethnic groups working together in different kinds of ways. One of the reasons the British are able to exert influence here for so long is that they are able to get one group to work with another under their authority or through them. Right? It doesn't mean that people see themselves as a common nation or a common state, but they are able to work together. A city like Herat, a city like Kabul, they are actually multicultural entities. They are cities that have had histories of people from different ethnic groups working together in different kinds of ways. So it doesn't mean that ethnic tension does not exist, but ethnicity is not destiny. Right? We often, as Americans, will look at a region and say, oh my gosh, I mean, you can't get this group to work with that group. That's not true. That's not true, right? This is a society that's accustomed to strange political bedfellows, people working in different ways. It's not Japan. It's not an island society. It's the opposite of an island society. I mean, historically, Afghanis have spoken all the languages. I mean, have been able to, because there are, I don't know, 300 or so languages in India. Right? And it doesn't seem to stop Indians from getting along. It creates challenges. Yes, yeah, but actually, you know, unlike what you see in Slumdog Millionaire, most Indians in slums and elsewhere don't actually speak any English. It's one of the problems with Slumdog Millionaire. All of a sudden, they come from the slum and they speak English, right? You wonder, how did they ever learn it? Right? And they don't, right? I mean, language is a problem, but language is also a strength, right? Because you can learn another society, you can learn another group's language, and you can connect in that way. So I think one can overstate that. I don't want to say language is unimportant, but I think one can overstate this. Historically, I'm very uncomfortable with saying that the ethnic definition of a group will determine where they come out in politics. I'm uncomfortable with that. Our society would have been in a lot of trouble if that were the case. Let me move on to say something about counterinsurgency. But before I do that, I do want to say something about Pakistan. So I'm going to get to this, but I'm going to say something historically about Pakistan. Pakistan we know more about because we know about the history of India and the end of British authority. Pakistan is not a state in the way that Afghanistan is not a state. Pakistan is also a failed state. I know if I have Pakistani friends in the audience, they'll disagree with me. I am of an Indian background, so I'm biased. But I think I'm still right. Pakistan is a failed state and has never been a real state. It has all the same issues as Afghanistan. It has all the same issues as Afghanistan. It is a crossroads area. It is an area that has no tradition of its own self-administration. It is infrastructurally lacking in many of the infrastructural elements that are in India, that are built by the British or that were built by the Indians themselves. And most significantly, it does not have a unified functioning economic base. It never has. Never has. Pakistan as a creation is created in 47 with Indian independence and the desire for there to be a Muslim state, a desire that only some have, not many, and the inability of India to convince certain Muslim groups that they will be able to have a peaceful, prosperous existence within India. And then this is encouraged by the British. As the British see this as a way of weakening Indian authority and perhaps even providing a basis for British return. So all the internal and external pressures move toward the creation of a Pakistan, but it is not a functioning state, and it never has been a functioning state as such. That's really important. And this borderland with Afghanistan is a problem from the very start. It's not something new to today. It's a problem from the very start. Problem of controlling access across that border, refugee issues. During the 1970s, this area up here, Quetta, which is a problem today, this whole area is filled with refugees. There's a problem of what to do with the refugees from Afghanistan in that area. And there's also a problem, of course, of Pakistani political authority. The entity that is created in 1947, before there is a functioning government, is a Pakistani military. Right? So the military makes the state. And we all see the reasons why that would be problematic. Because if the military makes the military will control the state. The Indian state is created before there's an Indian army. Congress Party pre-exists the Indian army. The Congress Party exists largely because of World War I. It has some predecessors, but the Congress Party is formed in India as a reaction to British extraction of resources for the war, extraction of bodies. And the Congress Party is the Indian response to that, and the British actually allow that, right? And that Congress Party will produce Gandhi and Nehru and others, right? In Pakistan, when this division is made, there's an army created and then a party to govern, right? Under Al-Jinnah. This is a problem for Pakistan, right? We need to think of Pakistan historically with Afghanistan in that sense. And it is also ethnically and geographically similar. I just bring you back to this earlier map I had, right? You can see it is like Afghanistan, a crossroads society, right? It's an area that is between big powers, not of the big powers themselves. And that matters a lot. But then let me talk about the Taliban. I hope this history helps us to understand the Taliban, because the Taliban is not entirely new either. But the Taliban is, in my eyes, at least, I don't know if others agree with me, they probably don't, but I see the Taliban as a function of the decline of authority structures throughout different parts of the world and the rise within various parts of the world of local entities seeking to assert authority over areas where foreign influences have been very strong. The Taliban is a reaction to a lot of what I've just said, and it has its home in Afghanistan, its main area of initial support in Kandahar. Right? It begins close to the Pakistani border, not in the heart of Afghanistan, and moves then through and eventually the areas, I mean, we know these areas from 2001, we're fighting there, right? Moves through and takes control of Kabul and Mazar-i-Sharif, but it's actually Kandahar where it's centered, and of course to this day they're operating in this region here. Mullah Omar is somewhere there right now, who knows exactly where. The Taliban is part of a set, I would argue, of late 20th century efforts by local entities to assert control over their own region. It is not purely an Islamic extremist entity. It adopts that ideology, the Taliban does, because it's what many people believe, but also because Islamic extremism is seen as an alternative political structure. What is seen as failed Western influence political structures. So I would categorize this, right, with a broader swath of anti-Western efforts of asserting authority. Islamic extremism, and it is extreme, it is horrible in the way that it sees the role of individuals and women and others in society. We all know these stories to some extent. We can get into them more if we want. But that definition of authority, I think, right, is actually used for purposes of political control. Not that people don't believe it, but it's also for political control. Why do I think that? Well, because what you certainly see with the Taliban, as you do with a lot of these other groups, is a sincere belief in a certain extreme Islamic point of view, but also a very obvious willingness to not follow those beliefs when they don't serve your political interests. From very early on, the Taliban is involved in the drug trade. You have to ask yourself, if you believe that deeply, that drugs are a horrible influence upon people, that any external, non-Quranic entity, like alcohol, drugs, is a crime. How can you be selling stuff? Right? The Taliban is deeply involved with this from the start. Now, their answer is they are not selling it, they are not using it. They are selling it to heathens to use, right? First of all, you are encouraging it. It would be like the Taliban saying, okay, we'll run brothels. We just won't let our own people go into them. Or we will sell rock music. We just won't let our own citizens listen to it. But they don't allow that, right? Why do they make an exception for drugs? They make an exception for drugs because the money from drugs helps them run their movement and helps them build their authority structures, right? They are believers in an Islamic extremist code, but they are even deeper believers in trying to build an alternative political structure. So let's be realistic, right? The Taliban is an alternative political movement, right? And what we are confronting in Afghanistan and Pakistan are political dissidents who have organized around a different ideology, fighting the kinds of influences that we support. That's what's going on, right? And religion is part of that, but religion is not the explanation, right? The Taliban builds off of madrasas and other institutions that provide financing for Islamic extremism, and they build off those institutions because those institutions provide them the bodies and provide them the money, right? Those institutions provide them the bodies and they provide them the money. And we should recognize that. This is about politics. And this is a war over politics in those terms. I stress this as strongly as I can, because I don't think the point is about fighting Islamic extremism then. I mean, it's a horrible thing. But it's about fighting bad political actors who have an alternative political viewpoint that endangers the things we believe in. And let's be really clear about that, right? It's not that we can say they should have their own religion and let's just leave them. We're not fighting their religion, fighting what they do with their power. The Taliban is committed, and it has acted, turn this region from Pakistan through Afghanistan into a home for its authority and to use its authority to exert control over other entities in that region. They are not about building Afghanistan for Afghanis or Pakistan for Pakistanis. They are about building power in the region for themselves. They seek power in the region, and that should worry us. That should worry us. That is the strongest reason why we should be involved in this region, right? Because this is about power, right? And they will not, they have no reason to simply want one section of this for themselves. Right? They are interested in power and control, just as we are, right? What their movement is about is saying that when we were just warlords, we were making compromises with Western powers. They had control. We want to do something different. We want to be, and it's a legitimate point of view. I'm not arguing that it's illegitimate to think that. But I think they seek to build an alternative system in the region, which would certainly include Pakistan, and probably include many other parts of the region. Don't hear me saying that means that they're a threat to our daily lives, but that certainly means that they are a threat to the region, and we need to think about this in regional terms. If we want to say they're going to do that in the region and we don't care, that's okay. If we want to say that, we can say that. But let's not pretend it's just about Afghanistan. Let's not pretend it's just about a certain group wanting to have control over a certain area. This is a much broader movement in that sense. It is a reaction. It is a reaction to Western influences. It is a reaction to failed traditions of local control. It is a reaction to what they see as other influences that are Western influenced coming in from India and elsewhere, right? And this is a very, very big deal. In that sense, it's not communism, but in that sense, it is a political movement that we would have to categorize in the way we would categorize things like communism, fascism, liberal democracy. It is another way of conducting politics, and we have to understand that. What that also means, right, is that they are an entity that will react to different kinds of pressures and incentives. Saying that a group is political, right, saying that a group is political means they are open to politics as well, right? So just their very aims that I laid out means that they are an entity that one can have political relationships with, right? A Clausewitz would be only one to say, right, that politics involves a range of things, right, from military conflict through negotiation. And all those things would be involved. This political movement, if I define it as a political movement, right, its formative moment, and you all know this, right, it's fighting the Soviet Union, right? And its formative moment involves making political deals to fight the Soviet Union. Why are they fighting the Soviet invasion of December 25th, 1979? That's when the Soviets invaded. They chose Christmas Day, right? Why are they fighting Soviet influence? Because they see Soviet influence as another element of Western efforts to control this area, and they see themselves as organizing against that. And they make three sets of political deals. Three sets, not just one. Three sets of political deals. First set of political deals. They say, well, in spite of the fact that we are ethnically different, and in spite of the fact that we are Sunni, we're Sunni and a mix of different elements that see themselves opposed to Shia influences, we will make deals with Iran and Saudi Arabia. Right? That's the first thing that they say they'll do, right? They will actually violate the ethnic lines. And in fact, the first thing they do is organize along those terms and collect weapons from those areas before the United States, right? Second deal they make, right, is that we will get aid and work with the United States to fight the Soviet Union, right? It's anti-Western, and so we will work with other Western entities against the worst barbarians at this moment, which are the Soviets. Third deal they make, we will build a political structure that will allow us to exert authority in an alternative way to the way we have done it in the past. This is what gets lost in this discussion. They are not just fighting the Soviets, and they are not just building an Afghanistan free of Soviet control. They are building a Taliban authority as such, right? And that's why you get that kind of government afterwards, okay? They are working to build that. That's what Osama bin Laden is involved in from very early on. That's what they're involved in, the kinds of institutions they build. That's what they're involved in trying to create a new structure that has them in control in a different way. They are making a political set of choices about trying to exert their authority in this region. And they see it as a much broader area. Their home of activity, actually, during the war in Afghanistan with the Soviet Union is actually in Pakistan, right? They're operating on the northern rim of Pakistan, moving into Afghanistan and moving out. That should sound familiar to us all, right? That's how they operate, right? And President Zia of Pakistan, anyone remember President Zia al-Haq, right? President Zia is actually closely involved in this process, providing them sanctuary so they can do that. So they're making a deal with Zia as well, right? By the way, the entity that becomes most important on the Pakistani side in helping this process is called the ISI. The ISI is the Pakistani CIA. The ISI had existed, but it was a small entity without much power until this happens. The ISI becomes the entity within Pakistan that most closely allies itself with this political movement, to help this political movement, but also because elements of the ISI are frustrated with their dealings with the United States and others. And so you get this curious relationship that develops between the Pakistani secret services, their CIA equivalent, and the Taliban that has never been broken. In fact, it's there to this day. And the worst thing that happens for where we are today is as that relationship builds, the ISI gets more powerful because they become the conduit for American money and American force into the region. And to this day, that's true. We've never broken out of that. We gave $5 billion to Musharraf's government. The vast majority of it went to the ISI because they conduct the operations in Afghanistan. ISI is allied with the Taliban. Think about that for a second. But that also tells you how the Taliban works. It is a political entity. They are Islamic extremists, but they make political deals. They have a deal with the ISI. Right? The ISI officers are secular, but they like the Taliban because the Taliban is anti-American, anti-Indian, and says people from this region should control it for themselves. Right? So what you have here is a broader political movement that grows out of this history and this geography. I think nation building is like running Chicago, right? It's Mayor Daley, right? It's Mayor Daley, right? It's going in and it's not pontificating about democracy. There's nothing in Afghanistan that makes Afghanistanis ready to have democracy tomorrow. It's not about Afghanis, right? It's about the structure of this society. You can't have democracy if you're growing opium as your main crop. It's just not, they don't go together. But I think nation building in Afghanistan would involve creating a police force, creating a civilian administrative structure, and putting people on the ground, not to be muscular military guys, nor to be democratic missionaries, but to be deal makers, right? What the government needs to do, what the structure needs to do, is make the deals that are necessary to make everyone feel more of a stake in the system than outside of the system. Nation building and the future of Afghanistan, I think, is about making this kind of long-term commitment. And I'm not sure whether Obama's doing that or not, but he seems to be at least going somewhat in that direction, and I'm sort of optimistic about that. How we do it is the big question. I don't think the way to do it was to go in and say, you know, now we've defeated the Taliban, we're going to send 100,000 troops there. That's not the way to do it. But I think to make a greater force commitment, but also to make a commitment of talent and intelligent investment, which is different from taking over. Which is different from taking over, right? Instead, we invested in bodyguards and a limited military commitment and cash payments to some farms.
I think what's absolutely crucial is a better relationship with Iran. And I the thing I'm most happy about with regard to his foreign policy is that he's clearly made that a priority. Before talking about Afghanistan, he reached out publicly to Iran. And the Iranians did not react as positively as we might have hoped. But they're in the midst of an election. And hopefully in June, when they have their election, things will change. And I'm not saying we're going to have, you know, friendship and hugging with the Iranians. But I'm saying we need to have a productive dialogue with them. Historically, I see nothing we have ever gained as a society by saying, we don't like your government, we're not talking to you. We did that with Russia in 1919. It didn't help, right? We did that with China from 1949 to 1972. I see absolutely no benefit. All that does is make us feel better about ourselves. With Cuba, I mean, I'm sure everyone in this room agrees with me. Talk about a failed policy, right? We should be talking to the Iranians. We have so many interests. That's where also where the deal making goes on. We don't have to say we like them. They don't have to say they like us. We have a lot of reason to cooperate in Afghanistan. They are much more fearful about what's going on in Afghanistan than we are, and they share our interest in a stable government of some kind there. And I'm optimistic that Obama sees at least that part of it. And if he does that, a lot of other things could become doable, it seems to me.
The foregoing program featured Jeremy Suri, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking Madison Institute forums are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of the sponsor.